Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today, we speak with Dr. Dale Bespalek, who has been a licensed psychologist in Wisconsin since 1978. He has served as the president of the Wisconsin Psychological Association and the dean of the Wisconsin School of Professional Psychology. Dr. Bespalek is currently professor emeritus at WSPP and the elected Wisconsin representative to the APA Council of Representatives. He maintains a consulting and clinical practice in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Today, we cover topics related to retirement and aging, oftentimes topics that are not thought about in our training or as an early career professional. We explored how values might change as a therapist or as a supervisor, and you'll find that Dr. Bespalek speaks through stories and narratives, which was really quite enjoyable to listen to. We hope you enjoyed the episode as much as we did. Dr. Bespalek, it's so nice to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. To get us started, you want to share a little bit about who you are, maybe share parts of your professional and personal identities?
Sure. As I usually introduce people, that one of the things that I guess I've been blessed with is I have a very long career as a psychologist. I was licensed in 1978, but I moved up in late 1977, off to an inauspicious start. When I applied for licensing, the state legislature closed and eliminated all licensing for psychologists. So here I had applied, I had a job offer, and they said, oh, by the way, there's no licensing until we get this figured out, which was kind of like, oh, there's a great start. So I've been, because of that career thing, I guess I've been really lucky to do a lot of different things. I think the one thing that's always stayed there, or the two things that have stayed there the most throughout all of this time, was being a psychologist. And that means to me bringing the science of psychology and enacting it. In other words, doing something with that science. That was the clinical part of that. And the second part was, is I always enjoyed teaching. And so my career is centered around teaching and instruction and providing psychological services. So I've had a chance to do things in just about every aspect of those, from inpatient hospitals, outpatient, in the schools. I worked in the prison system, worked in the forensic world, prevention and outreach, disaster response. So in many ways, I've had a lot of interesting things to do over my career. Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, Laura and I are both really interested in teaching. And so I think, you know, perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that today if we have time. But I wanted to share with our listeners. So you presented relatively recently a talk on retiring with integrity. And I thought that the way you went about that presentation was fantastic. Can you share a little bit about your talk and really what it was like to construct a talk like that?
Well, I at the last WPA convention, which was held this fall, I presented the idea of, as you move into retirement as a psychologist, you're moving along an evolutionary process, just like we do as we're growing, we evolve. And it seemed to me that there was a parallel, or at least there could be a parallel, some richness in using Eric Erickson's stages. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried to do is look at Eric Erickson's stages, which kind of said, look, there's this social personal interaction and conflict that then creates the movement toward the next step. And I thought, well, I wonder if that's similar to the identity or the growth of the person who is a psychologist. And so, I don't know, for whatever reason, I thought that was kind of a cool idea. So I went ahead and did that. And the way I tested it was more like, let me look at how I went through those roles. And to me, it was one of the things that was, interestingly enough, one of the first things that you're supposed to do in that final stage as you are working toward retirement, which is review. You know, you look back, because if you want to have integrity, you need to review all of those aspects of yourself, not just from a critical negative, but also from a aspirational achievement success perspective. Like, oh, what was I good at? What did I do? Because we sometimes forget all of those things. And I think in particular in the world of psychology, if you're a clinician, a lot of what we do is kind of hidden from us. We sometimes help people. We don't always know how we have helped people. I tell the story. By the way, just a warning, I tell stories. So if I tell stories, you know, feel free to edit them out. I was working at St. Michael Hospital, the mental health center, where I was a clinic director. And we had, at that time, I did a lot of work with adolescents. And so we had this whole really cool adolescent program where adolescents got individual work. There were people who were working with the families. We had adolescent groups. We had parenting groups. And so somebody came into our thing and our whole system kind of surrounded them. It was a wonderful program. And anyway, I had this one woman or young girl who was in there and had, you know, struggling in school and a few other kind of things, kind of rebellious, nothing horribly difficult, but just not living up to her potential and on the edge of getting into trouble, serious trouble. But anyway, she did very well in individual work and in group work and everything. And what was funny was, you know, she went off and then she stopped coming after a while. This was, she was in her, I think, junior year of high school. About 2 years later, no, I take it back. It was more than that. It was probably closer to 4 years later. I was walking down into the waiting area for my next client, and this woman stood up and waved at me. And I said, oh, hi, how are you? You know, I don't know if I remember. She said, I don't know if we met. I was seeing somebody else, but she said, I'm here to get my own therapy. I'm this young girl's mother. And I said, oh, really? She said, yeah. She said, after everything that she did and the changes that she's made, I decided that I had some work for myself to do. She says, and by the way, I told her that, and she said to say hello. She's now going to go to the University of Minnesota Medical School. And it was like, oh, wow. Oh, four-year follow-up. Now, you have no idea that happens. But I think that's the kind of stuff as you get to the end of your career that you need to hold and cherish and realize how important that was, that you had that at least some role to play in that person choosing one path versus maybe another, or at least going down in a way that they're becoming completely or so much more fulfilled in their potential than maybe they might not have had the opportunity. So to me, that was a big part of the journey. How did I get there? And when I got there at the end, is it worthwhile? You know, is it a time for me to take a look back with integrity and say, hey, I can accept that I've reached this point in my career. Long answer to a simple question. You seem to hint a little bit, as you said, that you might want to ask some other kind of more specific questions about that retirement piece of it. So maybe I should listen to what questions you might have about that.
Laura, do you have any that you want to throw out there to start us off?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if you've picked up on any patterns, or what are some of the things that stand out for you when you're reflecting on your own journey in psychology? I know you just told a story, but I'm wondering if there are patterns that you can pick up on.
Mm-hmm. Interesting question in terms of patterns. I think one of them may be illustrated by that story is that what we think our impact is going to be, it may not be that. And mm-hmm. so in essence, if you're looking back, you have to open yourself up wider than, oh, as an example, that story, did people get better or did they do this kind of things? There's other things that may have happened and you just don't know that. And mm-hmm. I think you have to open up and to take a wider look at those things. Working in the prison system, you know, hearing from somebody else years later that somebody, you know, did something well or improved in some way, but you wouldn't have looked at that. Sometimes it's simple things like, there was this one young man that I was working with in the last several years. It was going, again, young, moving into college, kind of going through some things and stuff like that. And some drinking, the kind of problems and stuff and everything. I get a call out of the clear blue. I hadn't seen him in 5 years, 6 years. And calls up and says, can I see you real quick for something? I said, oh, okay, yeah, let's get in. So I sat down and went to see him. And he sat down and said, blah, blah, blah. He had a close friend who had committed suicide. And he said, I went through a lot of the things that I reflected on myself and everything, but I'm really struggling a little bit. I just know that I need to talk to somebody about that and get it out. He says, we always were able to talk. So is it okay? We did this. So we talked a little bit like that. I mean, that's the kind of thing you don't know that you did. You don't know that you established, which is, I believe, mm-hmm. one of the key things about therapy, is that intimate relationship with someone that they can trust you, that they know that you're a person to go to. And, mm-hmm. I mean, had he not called me, I wouldn't have known that. But because he did, it's like, okay, so I touched that life in a positive way. I probably touched some lives in not such good ways. I remembered talking about other patterns. I'm talking about positive patterns. Maybe a negative pattern is you make a lot of mistakes. I remember after my first couple of years of practice, after I got my doctorate, and I was getting a little bit more mature, maybe, and a little having more sense. I was sitting around with a friend of mine and we were chatting and I said, I don't know, maybe I should just send everybody a refund because I'm not nearly as good back then as I am now. I mean, you start looking and think, oh, how did I do that? Why did I do that? Mm-hmm. Silly things that I know later that were different. So those are a couple of things. Another pattern for me anyway was, I think my career followed my own developmental changes. So as I wanted to look at different things in life and move toward different things, I found that other parts of psychology were more attractive to me. So mm-hmm. in the beginning, it was kind of community mental health and those kinds of things. And then I was at the school and it was real focus on developing the clinic and establishing that and getting, the clinical training pieces together. And then it kind of went into the HMO world of working with business end of things and contracting and stuff in order to how to best do things, apply science. And then I had kind of a midlife crisis, which was probably one of the bigger changes, was I really realized that I wanted to work with my true love, which was working with people with sort of long-standing personality or behavioral disorders. So like addictions or personality disorders, character disorders, however you want to talk about those things. And so then I made a shift to the prison system. but I guess the pattern for me was that I followed where I thought I needed to be and then found that psychology had a role to play in all of those things. And again, maybe that goes back to the first question, which was, how is it that you looked at the evolutionary process? I think my life was this series of changes and modifications to directions, not based on, oh, I need a job, but it was much more based on, gee, what do I really need to do right now? to fulfill myself and to fill those things. And for the most part, most of the times that when I made job changes, it wasn't to increase my salary. It was usually because of those internal things. You know, it was, no, this is something I really want and need to do. Again, long answer, but.
No, that's really beautiful. And even in my really short career that I've had so far, I've noticed just how much I learn about myself in the process of learning how to be a therapist. And I think about specific clients who have taught me things that they don't even know they've taught me. I'm wondering if you can think of any examples of maybe clients that you've learned from or situations that you've been in that you really learned a life lesson from.
I'm going to use something that just popped in my head because it was just very recent. Working with a woman who, again, depression, some anxiety types of things, but much more of a just some life event kinds of things and just not being able to get where she wanted to go. And as we have a good working relationship. And so we've been seeing each other for a while and everything. And one day, I was watching her as I was describing something and I came home and I thought, I'm missing something. Something's wrong. And so I thought about it and thought about it. And what I did was I reviewed a little bit about what she's been telling me. And okay, here's my side story to that. One of my mentors, training supervisors, used to say, he said, people, if you really know how to listen, his name was Eugene Kennedy, said, if you really learn how to listen, people will tell you what's wrong with them. He said, and they will tell you how they need to get better. He said, and what's really good is if you miss it, they'll tell you again. And I thought about that, and I went back to our next session. I said, I'm going to stop just for a second today before we get started. I said, I was kind of suggesting, that you look at this or this alternative or these kinds of things to solve the problem. And I said, I think I stopped listening to you. I think instead of my telling you or giving you suggestions here, I need to hear from you about what you're experiencing about that. And it was interesting. She smiled and she looked at me. She said, thank you. She said, that's what I need most is someone to listen to me. We went into, which interestingly, we went into some very, very deeper material from her childhood that really was affecting a lot of the barriers and stuff. So in some ways, I went right to the barriers and said, well, how do we fix the barriers as opposed to listening to her and letting her discover that? So I think one of the things I've learned from that was one example, but from other examples is your clients are always trying to tell you how they can get better. A simpler story that matches that was in my internship I did at the Heinz VA hospital in Chicago. And we had this guy, I don't remember his exact name, I'm going to call him Archie. Archie was a chronic schizophrenic, just classic. And Heinz had 1,200 inpatient units, beds. I mean, it was a big hospital back in those days.
Yeah.
And we would know that in the spring, lots of the vets, see, in the wintertime, they'd go down to Florida and they'd check in and they'd do their stuff in Florida. And then they'd get up and they'd get on buses and they'd come up to here because it's going to get too hot in Florida. So we knew that we'd get this rush. And well, Archie was well known to everybody. And Archie came in and he was really crazy and really off of his meds. And so I got assigned to talk to Archie about it and everything else. And so we were talking about it and everything else. And we were tied to the medical school. And so we had psychiatrists who were in training. And she was trying some different meds and everything. And my supervisor turned to me and said, didn't you talk with Archie? I said, yeah. And I said, did you ask him about what he needed to do to get better? Yeah. And he said, what did he say? He said he needed 400 milligrams of Thorazine 3 times a day. And he said he'd be out of the hospital in 2 weeks. And they put him on 400 milligrams of Thorazine 3 times a day. And he was out of the hospital in 2 weeks. You know, all of this stuff on the planning of things, like, what do you need, Archie? And Archie knew better than anybody what he needed. So from a two different perspectives, but I think one of the things, to answer your question, one of the things for me anyway was really learning how to not put my bias in the place, but listen to what your client or your whoever you're working with, the family unit, whatever, to listen to them for clues, because they may know it, but they may not know that they know it. And so that would be one of the big things I think I learned.
I can't help but think about training. And Laura and I are going on to internship this upcoming fall. And I cannot stop myself from really going towards that striving to doing. And I don't typically experience myself that way, but I've noticed it coming up a little bit more. And I noticed it right at the beginning of my training. I have to do more. I have to strive. And as I'm thinking about, you know, just retirement and grief, I don't think those things are compatible. And I'm wondering if you experienced that too at the beginning of your career, striving, wanting to do better, wanting to move up. And then when that shifted for you.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because there's that drive to like know everything, as you're saying, be better, gain skills. And then you start doing things. And one of the things that I found, and kind of going back to that, give people a refund, is I suddenly realized as much as I thought I knew, I didn't know. And that was a really scary, scary thought. For me in my career, was suddenly like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to know these things. You know, I'm in charge of this. I might even be supervising students. And suddenly I don't know the answers to those things. And my inclination was, well, I've just got to start doing more education and more education. And I think that was the first crisis for me to sit down and say, maybe you know more than you think you know, if you would settle back and listen carefully to yourself and also kind of look through those things. That doesn't mean that you still don't want to take some education and be kept up to date and those things, but to begin to just say, no, wait a minute, part of this is learning, is letting that happen. My daughter, who's in she's in the world of art. And so she went to the Art Institute of Chicago and got her degrees and is teaching. She's down in Tennessee now. And she was also an art teacher. And one of the things that she often said was, in the beginning, you know, this is paint, this is paper. I'm going to use that as an example. You know, here's the kind of things, you know, get it onto the paper and do those things. She said, then what you have to do is just let it happen for a while. And I think that's, to me, what the advantage of postdoc and everything else, it's your chance to try, let it go, experience it. Because then afterwards, you'll start then learning from that and then tightening it up again. And I wish I had done more of that. Instead, I kind of just did the, okay, I'm going to be perfect. I'm going to do all the things. I'm going to do all these kind of things. And I didn't get a chance enough to experience that process. So my advice is at that stage is let yourself experience it. Then you'll do the refining, you'll do the work, you'll gain appreciation for it. And then at the end of your career, you can start looking back at, oh, what was that all about? Mm-hmm. Is that online? Okay. The therapist in me always kicks in. I'm always asking the clients, like, did that make any sense? Or did I lose you anywhere along the line? So I if I do that a lot, it's because of my style. So it's not that I don't think you're understanding. It's more my confirmation of, are we connecting? And that's one of the things I hate about the Zoom thing, you know, or the video thing, is that it's harder to tell that. When you're in person, you know, you get all those clues, you know, and when you're over this virtual thing, it's harder to pick up the clues. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just want to comment really quickly on what you said about letting yourself experience. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about doing therapy is that it feels like there's room for mistakes. So if you're able to establish a good relationship with a client, you can allow yourself to make a few mistakes here and there. I mean, obviously you don't want to harm the patient and you don't want to have any sort of intense rupture in the relationship, but it's pretty, it's just really fascinating how, you know, you can allow the client to have space to make mistakes and you can also allow yourself to have space to make mistakes and you can always come back to those and discuss them with the client and go over it with the client. So I really appreciate that piece of advice about just letting yourself experience.
Yeah. And I really like your statement. It reminds me a lot of where something that both Dr. Smothers and I both kind of were online with, which is that whole idea of ruptures, is that ruptures are going to happen. So how do you use that rupture to, if you will, deepen the relationship rather than let it destroy the relationship? You know, and it's sort of like I've been married for 48 years. And yeah. as my wife and I often say things like this, it's like, it's not that we're not going to fight. You know, we're going to have arguments. We're going to have disagreements. You know, we're going to yell at each other once in a while for different things and everything like that. It's the fact that we know that despite all of that, the relationship is going to be there. So right. Because of that, okay, we express some feelings. Oh, I was wrong. You were right. Okay. And everything else. And we work through the resolutions because of that holding environment. So yeah, you know, yeah, you go ahead and experience it, but always, what is the holding environment? And I like what you said. It's like, yeah, it's a great chance to model for people. Things don't always go well, but that's okay. I have another story about that.
Please.
I was at the VA. One of the guys he did something fascinating. I guess I got to tell you about him. He was a psychoanalytic. I mean, you know, the couch thing and everything. Okay, classic psychoanalytic in Chicago. But he worked at the VA and he ran groups. So he did psychoanalytic groups. But what was fascinating, he did psychoanalytic groups, but he did this at the end of each week on Fridays. It was called Leon's Open Group. Anybody from anywhere in the hospital, if they got permissions and stuff, could come to this open group. The group could have 5 people, it could have 50 people in it. And it would be this gigantic group of students and staff and patients and everything else. You know, a little part with people would, you know, introduce themselves and everything. And it would just sort of play with this openness of experience. And again, I remember this one guy, I'll just make up a name. His name was Bob. And so we were going around, you know, though I'm a psychology intern, blah, 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 I'm this, you know, I'm, you know, Joe Smith, you know, I'm on, you know, unit 2C or whatever it is. And he got up and he said, "Hi, I'm Bob, schizophrenic." And he walked around and shook hands to everybody. He goes and he sat down and he says, "And my schizophrenic symptoms are getting better." And to me, it kind of like what you said was this was this holding environment. He felt okay to say, "Hey, I have schizophrenia and I'm working on it."
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, okay, just walked around, took everybody's hand. It was just, it was part of his identity. But it became, it became an acceptable part of his identity. It was the symptoms that were the problem. He wasn't trying to not be who he was. Right. So, anyway, funny story.
You know, as I'm listening to you talk and tell stories, I love stories, by the way. I think it's really important to tell stories. And what I'm reflecting on now is really how important your patients were to you and your clients. And I'm wondering if you've thought at all about what's going to be lost not working with them and how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, you know, I think that's... Again, I think that's wonderful insight on your part. I think that that's probably been the hardest thing for me as I've tapered down my practice and I've been much more selective and, you know, kind of looking toward things that are much more manageable as I've gotten older, but also, you know, keeping only a few people and doing things so that I can manage all those things. But you're right. It's the part that I miss the most. The two things that I miss the most doing is teaching and seeing my clients. And so part of that was important for me to try to keep that at least some some aspects of that as much alive as possible. So my current job, or the thing that I'm spending most of my time with now, is I'm a consultant with the Capuchin Friars. And one of the things I get to do there is I do like what would be called sort of in-services. I do little things. I just got through doing a thing on stress management. I did one earlier on, what did I do it on? Communication. And then I'm going to be doing one on emotional intelligence. So I do these little teaching things. But then I'm available to all of the postulants for sort of time-limited, just they can come in. They're in the program for about a year, so I know that they're only for the year. But they come in with their baggage as they're going on their journey. And so they come in and they talk about different things, and I'm available to do that. And I found that how valuable and important that is to me. But because it's also, I know that it's kind of time limited and I can do these things, it fits into, as I move on, and maybe if I can't do that anymore, it's easy to terminate. Because you get new people. So it's just, I won't take on new people the following year, that kind of thing. But at the same time too, I need to have that as a part of my life. You know, I'm not the kind, you know, again, I look at like Dr. Ackerman, who I have a great deal of esteem for. He and I have known each other for many, many years. We laughed when we moved to Florida. He was going to play golf all the time. Well, I see that he's still doing cases, he's still doing in services, he's still, you know, working on, you know, doing ethics things and stuff. And it's like, okay, don't tell me about retiring. You know, you're just being more selective. So for me, that was the answer to that, was being selective so that you could be there, do the job, but also not take on things that you can't be there for. But yes, I'm gonna miss that. That's the part that I have not been willing to let go of yet.
We haven't yet talked about your teaching and your supervising. Is that okay to pivot a little bit?
Sure.
Into that realm? Okay. I'm kind of wondering, you know, because that was such an interest of yours, I'm wondering how you are thinking about your career as a supervisor, as a teacher, really what that's meant to you.
I think I may have told this story at the WPA. It was kind of funny when I was just growing up in at that time, our house was in North Chicago, Illinois, right next to Waukegan. And I'm old enough that my mom had one of those washers that, you know, you hook the water up to and stuff, and then you pick the stuff out of it, you know, after it spun around, and you had to roll it through the top and a whole bit and everything. And so it took a long time. Right next to our coal-fired stove, coal-fired furnace. And so we were down in this room down there, and she was, and there was a section over there. Well, I was young, and so she had to watch me. So what are we going to do? So that was my play area. It was down in the basement next to her while she could do the laundry. And I remembered, you probably saw these things. They had like these little, at that time they were chalkboards, and you had little ABCs across the top, and you know, kind of just stuff. She turned around one day, and I had set it up as a classroom. I had little chairs, and I had these little stuffed animals all sitting in the chairs and stuff like that. And I was into the stuff. And I would watch programs on television like Ding Dong School and, you know, Miss Francis and all those kinds of things. And I was trying to teach my little animals, or my little stuffed critters and things. And she said, I remember she said at that time, she said, "You're going to be a teacher when you grow up." And so I felt somewhere along the line that was in me. So I really do love it. I love the interaction with the students. I've done some of this stuff with the virtual platforms, but I just hate it from that perspective, because I like the interaction. I like to be in the room and feeling it with people and stuff. So yes, I really loved that. And that's why, again, I keep doing some of those things. Supervision was always a little bit harder and harder for me, because in the supervision part, you're taking on responsibility as a supervisor for the clinical actions of somebody else who you had to trust. And one of the problems was is that you didn't always know the person that you were supervising very well when you started supervising them. So for me, it was always, I had to get to know the person, get to know the person. And students are in such a difficult, or supervisees are in such a difficult position because, you know, they don't want to not look good. They don't want to not look like they're saying the right things or doing the right things. And so they aren't necessarily, you know, they're going not necessarily going to ask the questions that are really going on inside of them. So I always found that to be kind of a challenge. Now, there's some people who just do it marvelously, marvelously well. And I've tried to use them as models and things. I liked doing it. And when I really liked it is when I felt like I was in sync with someone, when somebody, and I felt like we really had a good thing, you know. So, you know, a number of our graduates today are people that I had worked with, who are the faculty now, and as students, and almost, I think almost all of the ones that I can think of, at least off the top of my head, I had a really good connection with. And so I felt like our supervision was really, let's see how we can figure out what we're doing and how this is going, which I think was very fulfilling. But for me, I think it's the going back to your patterns question, it's in the back of my head always, is I think it's always been about the relationship. Relationships are so important to me. So whether I'm teaching or supervising or mentoring or working as part of a organization, it's the relationships that are just so important, more important in some ways than the final goal. Not that you don't keep striving for that, but the relationship is what sustains the energy toward that.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that.
I'm wondering too about values and what you valued within supervision and if that's changed throughout your career.
Sorry, I was for some reason I'm having trouble hearing some of what you said. About valuing supervision?
Yeah, I'm thinking about values and, you know, I'm imagining myself as an early career supervisor, and I'm imagining that my values within that that supervision experience would be different than, you know, if I was at the end of my career. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the differences that you've noticed in yourself in terms of values. It sounds like the relationship's really important, but I'm wondering if you've noticed anything else.
Yeah, it's an interesting question from the idea that how did that evolve? And I think in the beginning, I think a lot of that has to do with what we know and how comfortable we are. Early on when I was doing supervision, and I was, you know, within 5 years of getting my doctorate degree, I think at that point in time, I was much more focused and I didn't leave enough room in supervisory relationships. And I think part of that was because I wasn't as confident in myself. And as I grew and matured, I think my own self-confidence allowed me to have confidence in other people more. There's a TV show called Dr. Pohl. He's a veterinarian and he's in Michigan. And you know, he's like 70 some years old and he's doing all these kind of things and he has all kinds. He works with everything. And person after person would say things like, oh, you just got to trust Dr. Poe. He comes in, he always knows and he's quick. He looks at things and he just, you know, because he's seen a million of them. And I think I see you get near the end of your career, it's like, okay, I have a pretty good idea of what's going on here already. So I'm much more comfortable that my supervisee, where they're at. And so I can feel like we can just kind of ride along with this. It's like, I've been on that road before, so I'm not as worried. Early on, I may not felt like I was on that same road before. And so it's like, I'm kind of watching the driving and looking down the road and wondering what's up there. And so I'm not paying as much attention to the supervisee sitting next to me. So in an analogous way, I think for me, it's as I mature, I found myself feeling more comfortable in the role. And again, you know, go back to my early supervisees and say, you know, should I give you a refund? You know, because I'm much better now than I was then.
I always joke that I'm not going to retire. That's always been a joke that my husband thinks I'm probably crazy when I say that to him. But I think for me, there's a little bit of a fear about retiring, mm-hmm. like thinking about something coming to an end, which is really interesting because one of the areas that I'm really interested in is working with older adults. And so we talk a lot about loss and grief and life transitions. So it's interesting that I myself have this fear about retiring and ending my career. I'm wondering what kind of advice you have for early career psychologists in terms of preparing themselves for retirement. What do you wish you would have known or done differently? So any sort of advice?
Yeah. I like you, had often told people I'd never retire. And as a lot of my friends who know me well enough said, and you've lived up to that. They said, you're the busiest non-retired person I know. So I'm not necessarily very good at giving advice about retiring because I'm still kind of retiring. One thing though, I definitely would say, and again, I have some colleagues who I could thank for this, and that is that be open to, I mean, not only manage it yourself, but be open to comments or feedback from people that maybe you aren't doing as well at something as you used to. And mm-hmm. I found this true in the forensic world. To stay in the forensic world, you have to be on cutting edge all the time about something. And I found myself not really wanting to do that. And as a result of that, I found myself missing little things like, oh, yeah, I should. Oh, yeah. And, you know, and somebody would, as we were going over the case or something, would say, well, what about this? What about this? And I began to realize, you know what? I have to hang this up because I can't. I no longer have the energy or the abilities to put into it. So one of them is as you're moving along, be open to the feedback that sometimes you can't stay on the cutting edge of everything. And so the other part is as you're moving along, learn about yourself and those things that you want to keep doing, stay good at those things. So in other words, like for instance, I did a lot of assessment over my life and everything. I don't do any assessment anymore. I have enough colleagues and things that if somebody needs an assessment, I'm going to send them out and say, hey, please, you know, do this assessment for a reason. I can look at other people's assessments and interpret them and everything, but I know my skills aren't there to do that anymore. So I think one of the things is know what you're good at, preserve the things that you find most enjoyable and that you want to stay good at, and be okay with letting go of some of those other things. So I don't do forensics anymore. You know, I for the most part, I work with adults in therapy, maybe young adults and everything. I used to work with teens. I used to work with young families and everything. It's like, no, I'm not up to that anymore. I can't do that. So I think that would be one of my things is that looking back at my career, being okay with focusing it down and preserving the things that you can think that you can really work at right now.
That's great advice. Thank you.
So we have one more question for you, Dr. Bespalek. And sure. We typically ask our guests about the future, what you're hoping to do in the future. And I'm noticing myself getting a little bit anxious to ask that question because we have been talking about retirement this whole time. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to what you hope to do in the future. What are some things that you really want to do with the remaining time that you have in your career or even after?
Well, that's interesting because... you know, one of the things is, you know, we're on a 2-year cycle for licensure, you know, so, I just looked at it. It's like, okay, I'm coming up, I'll renew it. So that'll be at least 2 more years. Okay. So that, but as again, my wife and I were talking about this and I said, I don't know, maybe this is the last cycle within those 2 years that I'm going to be as active as I am now. And so I'm being very, very cautious. I'm letting go of things. I'm not taking on new clients that I don't think I can work with in a reasonable time frame so that I don't have this, how do I hand that person off and those kinds of things. And I think my focus is going to go back to something that I used to do for a while. I mean, I was with the Red Cross for about 10 years, 9 years. I'm fascinated by a program that I saw in the paper, and it paralleled something that I wanted to do. And I do some consulting work with the Sheriff's Department. I'd like to set up a network of community helpers, people with background counseling, those kinds of things, who will be able to respond to do psychological first aid when there are major events, okay? A house fire, a death of a thing, a significant car accident, whatever. And having people there who can give that immediate, this isn't therapy, it's psychological first aid, that immediate comforting and doing that stuff. And I think I would like to do is spend some time is putting that network together in my community and have that put into place. And, you know, maybe provide some overview and education and support to that, but let other people be able to do it. Because I think that's something that would be a benefit to the community. And so I'd like to do that. The other thing that I'm kind of working on as I'm getting near the end here is Dr. Jurenik and I have some common dreams. And again, they're kind of community-based. As a matter of fact, we're going to have breakfast next week. We started kicking around this site a couple of ideas about a year ago. And so we're thinking about seeing what we could do about trying to establish some ways in which to bring services more easily and seamlessly and not in the clinical format that we have, but rather in a much more kind of pastoral way. In other words, you're part of this community, and so within the community you have access, there's people here who can help you kind of thing, rather than the formal, oh, you have a problem, make an appointment, go see the thing. You know, there was a concept a number of years ago called parish nursing. And what it was the idea, I mean, it's the old idea of having nurses in manufacturing plants, nurses in schools. And the job was, is that, you know, somebody fell down, it's like, and got, you know, they, oh, there would be somebody there to kind of help you. Okay. And then, oh, if you needed more, they arranged that. So we're kind of kicking around the idea of what would that be like to open up access to more marginalized populations to help them be able to get into the system without having to go through the stigmatizing and the barrier programs. So we're kicking around those ideas, and who knows, maybe that's something we'll do. So those are a couple of things that I'm looking for probably in the next couple of years.
I did not know that, and I really wish I would have, because I would have loved to ask you about it. We do, we're almost out of time, but who knows, maybe there will be a part two to this conversation, because I think that is a really fascinating idea and something that Laura and I have actually talked about too. Opening up clinic very similar to that. So maybe, who knows, maybe we'll touch base later. And
I was going to say, maybe something with Dr. Jurenik, and maybe if we come up with some ideas, we could have sort of like a little conversation about that. I think it'd be good to have some other ideas about it too.
Yeah,
that'd be wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. And it has been such a wonderful, I mean, I've never met you in person, so I'm really happy to get a chance to speak with you and talk about your career and retirement. And I really hope our listeners are able to get something out of this conversation.
Well, it's been a pleasure. You guys made this very, very comfortable, very easy to do. And, you know, as most of the students and most people at WSPP know, that if you give me a chance to just talk about things, I'll just talk forever. So, but anyway, thanks a lot for the opportunity. I hope it provide some help and some interest to other people.
Thank you so much.